Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Late last year, Australian cyclist Cadel Evans came within a whisker of winning the Tour de France, the most televised event on the planet after the Soccer World Cup and the Olympic Games. There was no drug scandal, but Cadel Evans has been swallowing pills. They're electronic, and they're part of a plan to win Olympic gold.
Okay, hang on, folks.
A few months ago, on a bike bristling with technology, sports scientist David Martin used Cadel Evans to measure every aspect of the Olympic road cycling course in Beijing.
So this, now he goes, this is the GPS signal. That's Cadel Evans. He's out, and this is Beijing. So he's got a pill in his gut, and we're getting core temp. He's got an SRM power meter on his bike. So we've worked out the feeding protocols. We've worked out the tire selection. We've looked at the wind speeds and taken his helmet into wind tunnel testing. We've looked at the weight of the bicycle.
Hello, I'm Ian Townsend, and welcome to Background Briefing, where you're listening to how the Australian Institute of Sport has somehow managed to gather enough data to recreate the entire Olympic cycling course. Our cyclists are riding it now in a sort of flight simulator at the AIS in Canberra.
And imagine taking this turn, 70k an hour, going into two right-hand corners with a fence and a wall. Watch this.
We're a cocky nation when it comes to sport, but we're about to hit a wall.
Nice, fine. Out wide. Good one, Cadel.
We're in the middle of an international sporting arms race where huge amounts of money are being poured into sports science. The science is so good that we even seem to know how many medals Australia will win at Beijing. The consensus is 42. Sports science is a field that we pioneered, but in the cutthroat world of international sport, we're about to be outgunned.
This time they're away. Patrick Johnson got a good start on his outside. Batman got a flyer as well. And further out to James Dolphin and Sheehy going okay. Here's Patrick Johnson. Oh, he's pulled up.
The Australian Athletics Championships in Brisbane 2 weeks ago helped Olympic selectors choose our track and field team for Beijing.
Very strong at the end. And Daniel Batman goes away and wins impressively. Dolphin's third, second.
Like many athletes, Daniel Batman qualified for the Beijing Olympics after a lot of sacrifice.
Yeah, the hardest thing is with the family. Like, a lot of the time you're resting at home in between sessions, and it sort of makes you feel like a bit guilty that you're sort of sitting at home, but it's part of your recovery. So it's always plays on your mind. It sort of messes with you a bit.
Thank God for the AIS.
Yeah,
thank God for the Australian Institute of Sport, says Daniel Batman. And there's no doubt that the reason this sprinter and Australian sport generally have done so well in the past 27 years is because of the AIS. Daniel Batman was born in 1981, the same year that the Australian Institute of Sport was opened.
Most of top sporting events. The combined influence of our demise in Montreal in 1976 and the urgings of two reports, Bloomfield, 1973, and Coles, 1975, brought deliverance from the sporting doldrums when a major government initiative was taken on Australia Day, 1981.
And athletes working together through this institute will, I'm certain, produce great things for Australia and carry Australia's name high.
This promotional video from the AIS describes how the country was still seething about the Montreal Games 5 years earlier, where we won just five medals and none of them gold. It was humiliating, and so the Australian government poured hundreds of millions of dollars into sport and built the AIS to study the science and train the athletes. The payoff came at the Sydney Olympics in 2000, where we peaked with 58 medals, 16 of them gold. One study back then worked out that each gold medal had cost the country $40 million.
But here comes Australia. They're going to come over the line in fourth position. Gold medal!
The price of gold costs a lot more than that now. No one's done the figures, but maybe somebody should, because we are going to have to think about how much money we're prepared to pay for gold in the future.
I'm Andy Burnham. I'm the new Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. In my dream
in the UK, the British government's put it way above $40 million and has been busy writing cheques.
I hope you saw that big smile on his face. I'm Dame Kelly Holmes, National School Sport Champion. We're at the Sports College Conference in Telford.
A few weeks ago, a conference of sports colleges in England was told that the British budget to find and train athletes to win medals at the 2012 London Games was approaching £1 billion. Essentially, about $2 billion Australian dollars is being spent to find and train the athletes to win medals at one Olympic Games. Britain's Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, told the conference about how all this money will also help in education and public health.
So our ambition is very simple. It's to remove all the barriers to sporting talent opening up, to open up new opportunities and facilities alike. And to do that, we need a national effort, all of us working together, sports colleges, parents, and those in the sports world who can be role models for our young people.
When governments talk about the reasons they fund elite sport, they often talk about role models and the public health. But as we'll hear later, there's no evidence that there's any measurable community benefit at all. Also at the conference in England was an Australian sports scientist. Kevin Norton happened to be nearby on business and decided to pop in, and he was astonished by what he heard.
Yeah, I was fascinated by that. I was fascinated because it wasn't just the Prime Minister who was mentioning it, but all the ministers, the general discussion was always about Australia, and Australia had performed so well in so many sports for so long. And therefore, if we mirror these sorts of systems and put in money that matches the type of money in Australia, that there's every chance, with 60 million people, that they would take over from Australia. And it was almost embarrassing to listen to Australia mentioned so many times, but clearly there's this rivalry there that has been there for a long time, and I guess it's a relatively healthy rivalry, but it does make you wonder about the sort of money that they're throwing around, £1 billion, and much of it coming from lottery money over in the UK, but it's a lot more than we'll put in before the 2012 London Olympics.
Kevin Norton was especially interested in what UK Sport had to say. UK Sport's the umbrella body for British sport and hands out the money. The head of performance at UK Sport is Peter Keane, and he told the conference about Britain's goal to be in the top four on the medal table. I spoke to Peter Keane from his office in central London.
We aspire to be the fourth nation in 2012.
But that fourth spot on the table's our spot, Australia's spot at the moment.
It is, but I don't think you have a unique claim on it. So I think it's there for the taking, and I suspect we're not the only ones looking to take it off you.
2012 is London's Olympic Games, and you would expect them to spend up big. But it's not just Britain that's seizing sport and making it a national priority. It's happening around the world. Australia did all that in 1981 when we built the Australian Institute of Sport in Canberra. Here's the first chairman of the AIS, Kevin Gosper, in an interview with the ABC explaining how it made a difference back then.
Oh yes, I think the Institute was the most important initiative in sport since World War II. We got a grant of about $75 million of those days. It brought the focus back onto what was necessary to bring young athletes and teams up to international competition. We were able to bring in the best coaches. We were able to set up the best facilities. We were able to breed a mentality of the need for international competition. It was a very strong injection of professionalism, in quotes, into sport in Australia.
New South Wales, he goes clear at the end. A breakthrough performance by Joel Milburn, 45-91.
But we may already have reached our sporting peak. Today, the AIS has real competition from the clones of itself around the globe. Other countries have been looking at what Australia's done and copied it. And they've been hiring Australian sports scientists, doctors, coaches and administrators by the score. One of the pioneers of sports science is John Bloomfield, and he was the man who penned a report to the Australian government in the early 1970s urging them to build an institute for elite sport. Today, John Bloomfield is Emeritus Professor of Sports Science at the University of Western Australia.
There are about 300 Australians now around the world, and about 100-odd of them are in China right now, and about 60-odd are in Britain waiting for the Olympics there.
So this is a real danger then, is it?
A real danger.
We've lost a lot of our talent, and we're going to feel the effects of that in the next decade.
Yes. What we have done, of course, a great help to us was Eastern Europeans. The Eastern Europeans no longer being behind an iron curtain. Now, we got quite a few of those coaches, East German coaches, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, several Russian coaches. But, of course, their countries now are paying well to keep those coaches back in their own countries. We're trying to buy some of our coaches who've been overseas and are doing very well back into Australia. But in most cases, we can't match the salaries. And that's a real problem.
On the outskirts of Canberra, in the shadows of Black Mountain, the Australian Institute of Sport's campus is spread through bushland, and it looks a bit like a safari park for athletes. A flock of cyclists wheels by beneath the gum trees. It's the middle of the Olympic selection trials, and Olympic athletes are hard to spot. Many aren't here. They're at the Institute's other campuses around the country or overseas. Some of the cyclists are in Europe with their professional teams. Inside the restricted science and medical building is sports scientist David Martin. He's an American who came to Australia 14 years ago because this was where sports science was cutting edge. He's now the senior scientist for the AIS's cyclists, and the technology these days allows him to be with the cyclists wherever they are, even if they're climbing a mountain in the Tour de France.
I can actually track cyclists in the Tour de France. I can be sitting in my underwear at home drinking a cup of tea at 2 in the morning, and on the internet I can have a live transmission of an athlete's power and with GPS his position in the world. If he's going up Alpe d'Huez in the southern part of France, I can see that unveiling itself to me live. If I was so inclined, I could call the coach in the car on the day and say, the heart rates are very high for this athlete for that given power. I think he's going to be fatiguing quickly. So those are really interesting technologies, and those are probably just three of the biggies, and there's all kind of nuancey technologies. There's big breakthroughs going on right now in sleep monitoring, and people are talking about smart mats where you basically would download the bed after a night's sleep to see how good the quality of sleep was. Were you restless, tossing and turning? What was your breathing rate? What was your body temperature? We have little pills now that were developed by NASA, and they're commercially available. You can swallow these pills, and a small recorder can pick up your core temperature, so you can see how hot the athlete is, engage levels of dehydration. So you can pee in a bottle and with dipsticks and small analyzers, see if somebody's dehydrated or not. So it just goes on and on. It's a very exciting time to live.
David Martin can track AIS cyclists such as Michael Rogers and Cadel Evans, whether they're competing in the Tour de France or a time trial in Beijing.
And then there's gyros that are in there as well, and the gyros allow you to pick up angular acceleration. So because they're small, you can position this onto an athlete and just... So you know, we took one of these and put it on Michael Rogers and Cadel Evans when we went out for a reconnaissance project at the Beijing Olympic course.
David Martin showed background briefing something that only a handful of people have seen. In August last year, the world's top cyclists were invited to ride the Olympic road course in a competition called Good Luck Beijing. David Martin loaded his cyclists with sensors and filmed what happened. He's showing the film on his computer.
So he's already dialed the turn in. Right now, we're a year out, and he's dialed it. He's happy. Yep, because I know how to ride it. So that's just got to help when you're looking for every second.
I don't know, would you change any of that? That would look a pretty nice line. That was good.
So the other thing is, by having the recording there, we're talking about, well, it's live and in your head, fresh. As a coach, would you tell him to do anything? Did you see anything to improve? He goes, no, he's nailed it. He's a professional. He's practiced, done it in comp. We're ready to go.
Sitting in his office, David Martin fast-forwards through the vision of the Beijing race on his laptop.
This part here, what you'll see, he's going to be going, get up to these real high speeds here. He's actually going downhill, and this is 65 to 70 kilometers per hour without a wiggle. There's not one wiggle on this course, so there's no break. We've never seen a course like this
ever at an Olympic Games or in a World Championships.
What does that mean?
It means that the demands of this competition are entirely unique. And with unique demands, I mean there's great opportunities. So we're hoping that we can take these unique demands and texture his fitness to really show itself on this type of a course. And we're hoping other people, who maybe are very competitive with Cadell in a time trial, are not taking it as seriously, don't realize that it's quite unique with the temperature and the terrain, and they're not as specifically prepared.
Yo,
800 meters here. The Beijing crowd that they brought in for the test event. Right up ahead of him is the Great Wall of China. So he actually goes up this very steep pitch here, and you'll see the gradient gets up over 7-8% grade. They'll have been riding for over an hour, 10. And then you see the Great Wall of China, and there's the finish.
Let's see, we're at about 32, 15, 16.
That's fine, mate. Come on, take it all the way through. All the way through the line, mate. Come on, take it all the way through. Good 20. On you,
and then that's going through the finish line. So I'll go ahead and stop it. Basically, Cadell won the test event, but the big thing wasn't about whether he won or lost. It was about all the data we were collecting.
Are we okay to give some of this out?
No. This is there's only a couple places where this resides. We don't really give it to anyone.
For anyone else to do anything.
As the film ended, David Martin's colleagues, who are in the room, ask whether it's wise to give this out to Background Briefing, to let the public hear about what they've learnt from the course. David Martin is saying, who cares now? It's too close to the Olympics to help the American cyclist, Levi Leipheimer, who they consider is Cadell Evans's main rival for a medal.
Even if somebody had my laptop and had all the data, maybe I'm just being a bit cocky, but I'd say, bring it on again. Me and Cadell and Levi and who? Everyone in the US used to be my students.
And as we heard, the AIS has rebuilt the Beijing road cycling course in a sort of flight simulator.
We have a bicycle downstairs, and it allows us to program the bicycle to allow the resistance to simulate climbing, which is a real dead feel, the bike doesn't carry, and also the descent, which in Beijing is going to be exceptionally fast, 65, 70 k an hour for over 10 minutes on the descent. And so we can allow them in a heat tent, so we have like a heat chamber, to feel the temperature and also see the images and also face the same resistances. So it's like a flight simulator for the athletes. And that's where we will iron out their drinking protocols and their pacing strategies.
Would other countries be doing something similar?
Some will be doing it as a media stunt, a little bit of shock and awe, so that other countries go, oh my God, look what they're doing. And you find that the people that know the most are actually a little bit quieter about it. I was speaking to a neighbor of mine who's an F-18 fighter pilot, and he said the pilots you're actually worried about are not the ones full of bravado and telling you everything they do. They're the ones that are a little bit quieter and just sit in a corner studying how to kill people. Yeah.
It's that killer instinct that also separates elite athletes from the rest of us. It makes that quaint Olympic creed seem almost naive. The creed usually flashes up on a screen somewhere at the opening ceremony and says,
the most important thing in the Olympic Games is not to win, but to take part. Just as the most important thing in life is not the triumph, but the struggle. The essential thing is not to have conquered, but to have fought well.
That's the creed. But you won't see that sort of sentiment in the strategies of the AIS, and especially not UK sport. UK sport's strategy for the London Olympics has been given a name, No Compromise. Its point is simple too. Win medals. Head of performance at UK Sport, Peter Keane.
So no compromise. It means a lot of different things to different people. For us, it's saying it does take a certain amount of money, time and effort to do this properly. If you don't have those things or aren't willing to do them, then realistically you're not going to win. So game over, really, which may sound quite Australian, I don't know.
How much money?
In simple terms, we're spending about £100 million a year on our entire elite sports systems for both Olympic and Paralympic sport.
And this is a fundamental change in the attitude to sport in the UK, says Peter Keane.
You could categorise British sport in the past as being kind of like wanting to see people achieve in a very kind of individual heroic way, but not through any kind of systematic programme of development, whereas now I think we're a lot more willing to accept that that's probably how it has to be.
Back in Canberra, at the Australian Institute of Sport, it's breakfast time. Basketballers graze on plates piled high with huge amounts of food. A lot of the athletes here are just kids fresh out of school, but their shapes and sizes can be a little alarming. Just around the corner from the cafeteria is the office of the current director of the AIS, Peter Fricker.
So I'll basically tell you, he's talked to
Dr. Fricker is a sports scientist himself, and it's become part of his job to stop the AIS losing its coaches and scientists and their techniques and gadgets to foreign countries, especially the UK.
We are consciously aware of the fact that we've done a lot of work, and I could use examples of where we've put a lot of work into developing very, very good scientists, very talented scientists, and I've learnt an awful lot about our particular high-performance system in a particular sport, only to lose them to another competitor country. And indeed, immediately after London, someone counted up something like 30 or 33 Australians in key positions in English sport. We've lost really good scientists to programs in the UK in particular. And you sort of think, it's just a bit frustrating that we've done all this work to develop their expertise, and they might have done PhD programs with us, embedded, immersed in a particular sport at high level, and these are our Olympic medal winning sports. And suddenly these guys have been recruited overseas, and you think, So in a way, we try and trade on their patriotism and say, don't go, we'll look after you, we'll try and keep you here. But it is a fact of life, because by the same token, if we see a very talented person from overseas, we're unashamedly going to go and chase them.
In fact, Dr. Fricker's predecessor, former AIS director Michael Scott, recently became the National Performance Director of British Swimming. He's helping the UK produce Olympic swimmers, and he's taken that job over from another Australian, former AIS swimming coach Bill Sweetnam. Dr. Fricker is the public face of the AIS, and he says he's relaxed about the brain drain, but there's no doubt it's hurting.
When we look at what we have to do as scientists in Australia comparing what they're doing overseas, there's an acute awareness of maintaining a competitive edge, so that if we develop a methodology for either talent search or talent development or technology for monitoring or measuring performance in a particular event, then we want to keep that a secret. We know that in conversations between scientists from overseas and us, and we play that game. We say, well, I'm not going to tell you all that, and they'll say, well, I'm not going to tell you all about what we're doing. So you're constantly testing each other to see, you know, who knows what and where they really are at. And having said that, there's a strong camaraderie, I guess, that exists between applied researchers around the world. I mean,
well, it's almost like a sport in itself now, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It's the same ethic. It's the same sport. So what happens off the track and all that sort of thing is fantastic. You can have a beer and have a chat and all that sort of gear. But once you're in there competing, it's, well, no, all bets are off and we've got to win.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Background Briefing. In 6 months' time, most of us will be watching the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics. This is the mascot song that you'll hear at Beijing. The mascots are five childlike characters who will be spreading the Olympic message of friendship and peace. But of course, the competition's cutthroat between the countries. National prestige is at stake. There's a sense when you speak to Australian sports officials that they're trying now to lower expectations for the Olympics. We're used to winning, to climbing the medal tally, but this time we're likely to slip further down. We'll probably slip to fifth or sixth spot at Beijing, with the 42 medals we're expected to win there.
That is a monster throw, ladies and gentlemen!
We won 58 medals at Sydney and 49 in Athens.
That's an enormous effort from Jared Bannister. He came in with purpose. He hit it sweetly.
89 metres out, T! Australian record, if you don't mind!
Medals and funding are closely linked. Any slip in funding or medals worries the Australian Sports Commission, which distributes the government's sports budget. The Sports Commission's head office is on the AIS campus in Canberra, and its chief executive officer is Mark Peters.
You know, we and the AOC are predicting Beijing's a 42-medal performance, maybe a 40-medal performance. That's down on 8-9 on what we did in Athens. But in what we're seeing worldwide, that's still an extraordinary performance for a country of 20 million people. And there's just increased competition all the time.
To To win medals, you have to invest years ahead, and the money for the London Games is being spent around the world now. The Australian Sports Commission has $217 million to spend a year, of which about $42 million goes to the AIS. But there's talk now, not of more money, but of less. Mark Peters doesn't want to dwell on it.
You know, we don't have any fears about a change of government being a negative for the way sport goes ahead. We still need to mount and convince many people on the value of sport.
There was a suggestion that there would be a review, though, of sports funding that would require some sort of change. Are you concerned about that possibility?
No, as I said, the AIS back in the early 80s was a radical change in the way that we approached, particularly the high-performance development of sport. And I think, you know, we're always challenging ourselves and that not to be complacent. The same way athletes have to find that centimetre or that point sum of a second, we have to find how can we use technology in a better way. We're setting a training base up in Italy at the moment because we know that most of our athletes in a number of the Olympic sports will need to be in Europe competing for 6 months of the year. So rather than flying back and forward, how do we establish a home away for home, home away from home, with all of the sports science, medicine capacity so that we can help them in their development. And that'll be a saving at the end of the day.
Come the federal budget in May, the AIS and the other sporting bodies will find out whether the Rudd government's going to force them to make those savings as it cuts its budget to rein in inflation. It's a perennial battle for people such as John Bloomfield, who's spent 40 years lobbying politicians to give sport more money, and he's still lobbying.
Politics has always been in. It suited some governments, and it suited certainly the Fraser government until they got caught up with the politics of the Moscow Olympics and then later the Los Angeles Games. And people like John Howard, he loved the cricket and he liked the rugby league, but he went to a lot of other things as well, and it's pretty political, the whole business now.
A few weeks ago, the Prime Minister was filmed by a television camera crew bowling a few overs to his staffers in his courtyard at Parliament House. It was woven into this Channel 9 news report by Laurie Oakes.
It was a happy Kevin Rudd enjoying a game of cricket with government staffers in the Prime Minister's courtyard last night. He just learned that the latest news poll showed his personal approval at an overwhelming 70%. No spin needed on that. It's a new record.
Sports popular. And it makes political sense for politicians to share the public's enthusiasm. And we're all proud of our athletes when they do well. But it's actually hard to say whether sporting success does anything else to help the economy or the community's general health. Professor of Exercise Science at the University of South Australia, Kevin Norton.
Well, I think more research needs to go into that. I'm not sure what the downstream consequences are for a high national pride. But in Australia, we know that sport and international sporting success is the number one indicator of national pride. It's above our technology, our science, our art and our history, our social security system, our military strength. All of those things were rated by a random survey in Australia and many countries overseas. And Australia was one of only two or three countries to rate sport as the number one indicator of national pride. It's important for our psyche, at least in the short term, and it's definitely good for politics.
Kevin Norton's also the researcher who 8 years ago published a paper on the monetary price we pay for Olympic gold, what we're prepared to pay to be proud.
Sport at the elite level is expensive and becoming more expensive. So we estimated, for example, back in 2000 that it was about $40 million per gold medal that we won. I imagine that with inflation, that cost of Olympic gold, if you like, has increased. That's just general inflation. But it also inflates at a faster rate because other countries like China and the UK, as we've mentioned, are putting in so much money. So it's like an international sporting war where it's going to cost a lot more to stay in the same relative position on that international league table. So we'll need to increase the funding if we want to maintain our position. What I've seen is a fairly constant funding pattern up until several years ago, and that would suggest to me, because funding is linked or correlated so closely with international success, that our relative position will fall over the next few years. So I wouldn't be surprised if we dropped our fourth position even as early as this year at in Beijing.
But as we heard, the British government's spending hundreds of millions of pounds to make sure the UK wins at Australia's expense. And Peter Keane from UK Sport says he's confident that success in London, and success means beating Australia, will lead to more money for UK sport in the future.
It's certainly my personal ambition that the case we will have made come 2012 is not only that we're able to perform at that level, but that we've done a damn good job of building this system and infrastructure that we're talking about. The pressure's on us to justify it and to show that we are that good and that it's a valuable thing for a nation to have and worth the investment in it.
But Australia has been incredibly successful, and yet back here, we're being told that sports funding, at least at the elite end, could well start falling.
We are fighting above our weight. And
2 weeks ago, at a press conference in Brisbane, the head coach of Swimming Australia, Alan Thompson, warned of a looming disaster for sport.
I think we're at the crossroads of in sport in Australia. We need to make some major changes in the way we fund a high-performance sport if we are to compete with the 300 million people from America or the 1.3 billion people from China. You know, we can go to Beijing, and I'm confident that in Australian sport we'll have a good Olympic Games. But it may mask underlying issues that are occurring through no further increases in high-performance funding.
The underlying issue he's talking about is the time lag between funding and performance. The medals we'll win at Beijing were paid for 4 to 8 years ago. So if funding falls now, we can still win a lot of medals at Beijing. The crunch will come in London 4 years after Beijing. John Bloomfield says a federal funding cut to the Sports Commission now will have dire consequences for the games of the future.
If we take a 10 to 15 million cut, or we continue to drop behind on CPI figures, that's very significant. That affects a lot of our programs. $15 million wipes out most of the support for Olympic athletes.
A certain percentage of the population, it's less than 1.5%, has the potential to become elite athletes. Australia has about 280,000 of them. You might have been one, but maybe you played soccer instead of basketball. You missed your chance, and you'll never know it. In the US, there are about 4.2 million potential elite athletes, and in China, nearly 23 million. The problem's trying to spot them and put them into the right sports for their physiology. In one way, Australia's lucky to be a small country, because the argument goes that these people are easier to find here. It's also been easier to concentrate our resources and marshal public support for them. David Martin, a sports scientist who specialises in cycling, came out from America 14 years ago because he liked Australia's sporting ethos and our cutting-edge science.
When you see a 100-metre sprinter win a medal from Australia, people from Australia, they just think, this is phenomenal, we can do anything. In cycling, I think, is a great example. If you were to logically think of where Australia should strike medals at, you would not pick cycling. It is an extremely competitive sport. They all say they're the most competitive, but it is very competitive. Swimming, yes, we'll take that one. We live by the ocean and everybody believes in swimming, that's fine. But cycling, you've got to be kidding. Or athletics, you know, that's just not for us. Away in the women's 400. It's too hard. We're too small. I think it's great for Australia to set the most ambitious goals. And what we probably forget is that the bigger nations, the bigger you are, the harder it is to organize, and the harder it is to innovate, and the harder it is to actually follow through on an idea. So the U.S. implodes in many ways with their top athletes knocking themselves out of eligibility for the Olympic Games. And then when the best person who finally beat themselves up to get on the team gets there, they're so beat up they can't perform well.
51-45, another A qualifier.
In international sport, athletes compete for countries. They usually don't go around swapping sides. The coaches and scientists, though, are professionals in an international industry, and they're free to go where the money is. Many of them do. Out of the lab and down on the AIS track, the sprinters and long jumpers and javelin throwers are practicing. looking down on them from his office in the stands is the Australian Institute of Sport's performance manager, Tudor Bidder. He's the Welshman who coached Britain's track team for the Sydney Olympics. He was bought by the AIS and Athletics Australia 3 years ago. From the stand, we're watching a group of South Koreans jumping hurdles, and some Japanese Olympians have just arrived. Tudor Bidder invited them here.
We specifically targeted this particular group of athletes because they're semi in our competition cycle. So the Koreans are going home to compete in their trials and the Japanese in their trials in April. So they're in form at the same time. Whereas if we went, we've got two guys coming out from Britain at the end of this month after our trials, so we can start winter prep with them. So really what we're looking for is a guy here called Asahara, who's a sprinter, and we want to pinch his start. He wants to pinch our guy's finish, so we'll make sure we can pinch his start first.
Japanese sprinter Asahara is a big threat to Australian sprinters. It's not just that he's fast, but he's quicker than most off the blocks, and that can make all the difference. It's often the case at the Olympics nowadays that the faster athletes lose a race because of their start or finish. That's where the science can help. It's especially the case in the pool.
Away, Kieran Perkins dwelt on the blocks in the race that could prove to be historic, both from an Olympic point of view and from an Australian history point of view.
The AIS has a new $17 million high-tech pool, and much of what's studied here are starts and finishes. You can dream about winning medals at the Olympics, but it simply won't happen today without technology. In charge of the AIS pool is biomechanist Bruce Mason.
You can't say that Australian athletes are superior to American athletes. They're not. You know, we're all from the same stock. And the coaches, they mix around with other international swim coaches and they learn the technique. So our coaches can't do anything that's so super different to another nation. So therefore you've got to look at, well, if it's not athletes and it's not coaches, what can we do? Okay, we're going to use technology. And this is what we've decided upon here in this pool. Use technology where it never has been used before. Once we're successful here, you can bet pools like this will develop all around the world. The one advantage we have is you can't build a pool like this overnight.
This pool is fitted with everything the scientists could think of. There's a $70,000 starting block that measures the angle of the dive and the force used by the legs. There are high-speed cameras everywhere. It's all been built to shave fractions of a second from a swimmer's time. That can be the difference between gold and no medal at all. At the Sydney Olympics, for example, Grant Hackett won the 1,500 metres from Kieran Perkins.
25 metres clear of a very, very brave Kieran Perkins. Grant Hackett is the new hero. He is the new king.
When Bruce Mason analysed that race later, he saw that Perkins actually swam faster, but Hackett was quicker in the turns.
The top swimmers, they swim at about the same speed, unless, of course, you're a Thorpe or a Phelps, and it's the little things like the turn or the start that'll give you that edge to win.
So is it a competition then between athletes now, or is it a competition between people like you, between the scientists and the technologists?
I think it's a bit of both, actually. Like, we're proud of what we've done with this pool here, and we've had a lot of nations actually come through, and we're quite prepared to give them a look and see what they've done. In fact, a couple of nations have actually come back to us and said, look, we'd like to share the information. We'll share our information with you if you share the information you've learnt in building this pool.
That's a new sporting ethos, the sharing of technology.
Well, we don't share. We won't. Why should we give another nation an advantage? Like, that's the only reason where we believe that our swimmers will be successful overall. There's always going to be the Thorpes and the Phelpses that are going to be successful no matter what. But if you look at the group of swimmers below them, any advantage they get is the thing that could put them on the medal podium. If we are successful with this pool, and if the swimmers in Australia perform well at the London Olympics, so I'm looking more at London than I am in Beijing, I think we'll have a lot of investigation as to why they've done well and what we've done in this pool to make them swim well.
All this science costs a lot of money, and mostly it's you and me, the taxpayer, who's paying for it. But unlike most other things we pay taxes for, it's unclear what we get back, although Bruce Mason has no doubt it can improve the nation's health.
I find it hard to think we're tossing billions of dollars into sport, but when you think of what sport does to the community and the health problems associated with the community, I think then you realise there is an importance in having sport because you're seeing what the best people in your nation can do. So I can justify the amount of money that's going into technology and sport because I think it will result in many cases in the health benefits.
The theory of role models getting kids active does seem logical, but in fact there's no evidence to support it. As we heard earlier, we paid $40 million for every gold medal we won at Sydney. Before the Sydney Olympics, Kevin Norton co-wrote a paper called The Price of Gold. What we're buying is a healthy national pride, but there's no evidence that we're healthier for it in any other way. Kevin Norton.
If there is any evidence, I'm not aware of it, and I would argue that it's short-lived. So if we are successful in the year 2000 in women's water polo, for example, and we had a surge of interest in women's water polo after that, and I don't doubt that we did have, that it's short-lived, and that often the people who are moving into those sports were coming from other sports anyway, so it's athletes changing from one sport to another, rather than people who were sedentary or not involved in sport suddenly thinking, well, I'll go and join a water polo team. There may have been the odd person, but generally there's very little evidence to show that's happening, and in fact, the proportion of people who are inactive has slightly increased over the years.
A number of studies show that since the 1980s, around the time the federal government started pouring money into elite sport, the number of Australians who are obese has actually doubled. That's due to several social reasons, of course. It's not because of sport that we're getting fat. But some things that we're doing might not be helping. Sports professor Kevin Norton has been critical of the elite talent identification programs, for example. The way they work is a bit like genetic selection. Some tall people with long arms might be ideal rowers. You can look at a group of kids and pick them out, but by doing that, you bypass that evolutionary process where all the kids play lots of sports over many years and hopefully some of the best ones gravitate to the sports they're good at. Kevin Norton's worried that that natural selection process is happening less and less.
They tend to bore down into the younger and younger age groups looking for talent. Yes, there is a problem with that. It works very well if you want to develop young athletes and win medals. But the problem is, of course, the downside is that there is less community involvement. You tend to find that young people who aren't selected at a young age into those elite programs fall by the wayside, many of them through interviews and work that has been published, particularly in New Zealand, show that children who are not chosen tend to think that they don't have what it takes and therefore sport is not for them and they tend to drop out.
But it's complicated. Parts of society are also becoming less active than others. Sports scientist John Bloomfield says his studies show that people in wealthier suburbs are actually more active than they used to be.
And dare I say this, at the bottom end of the socioeconomic scale, and you've only got to go to supermarkets in the bush or the very big shopping malls on the outskirts of most of the cities and you'll see very large people, very obese.
So why do you think that is? Is it that sport has become something you have to pay a lot more money now to if you want to participate in it?
No, I think it's a cultural thing and it goes right back to education. No education department in the states of Australia have supported health and physical education by putting a specialist in. It's a bit like music. If you don't have somebody that's well trained there, the kids don't get the right sort of thing. The teachers tend to throw them two or three footies and two or three netballs and say, carry on, because they're not specialists.
John Bloomfield's pointing out something here that Kevin Norton agrees with. there's a bigger role for the education and health departments to encourage society to become fitter. The community's general health isn't really the priority of the Sports Commission or the AIS.
You know, it's one of those things that sometimes appears to fall in the cracks. Sports Commission don't see it as their main role. Department of Health have very little of their budget to focus on health promotion and even less on physical activity promotion. So, you know, we're seeing declining rates of activity and increasing overweight and obesity and so forth. So it's one of those issues I find it, and many people in my position get frustrated because we feel like it is lost from the national agenda. And, you know, the general community are suffering. But at the same time, we all love to watch TV and love to watch our elite athletes perform, and we feel good about ourselves and our country when we see success on the international stage. So, you know, how do you get all that balance right?
That's something UK Sport's been thinking about too, as it spends its hundreds of millions of pounds on elite athletes for the London Games. The head of performance at UK Sport, Peter Keane, says you just can't put a dollar value on it because it's actually about quality of life.
I'm not aware if the case can be made for, you know, the improvement in well-being or national productivity. For me, it's part of the quality of life that is very hard to quantify and define, really. Just one anecdote, coming back from Sydney in 2000, where I managed the British cycling team, and we'd had a breakthrough there in terms of, you know, gold medals and total number of medals. And just returning home and walking around the estate where I lived, I bumped into a cranky old 80-year-old who I kind of vaguely knew, sort of chain smoking ex-medic, very interesting character. But she stopped me in the street and said, you know, you made me feel a foot taller when I saw those results. And this is somebody, you know, didn't care about sport or really follow it. But it's hard to quantify, but I think it is part of nationhood, and it's a part of the quality of life that we aspire to.
Back in Australia, at the Sports Commission and the AIS in Canberra, there's a little less confidence about the future. Some of the athletes on scholarship are selling muffins to help pay their way.
We have raspberry and white chocolate or apple and cinnamon.
They're $2 each.
If they're lucky and work hard and keep making sacrifices, they might win a gold medal or find a sponsor or be signed up by a professional sports team. Some will enter the world of commercial sport, which is really the world of entertainment. That's where the real money is. And sports scientist David Martin says in the end, that's what it's really about. We want these athletes to do well simply because we enjoy watching it.
The reason sport is a multi-billion dollar industry is because everybody wants to watch it. So although people try to link us at the Australian Institute of Sport and Elite Sport into the health side of the agenda, we're not about diabetes, we're not about obesity, we're actually in this entertainment industry. We're about helping the youngest, brightest stars of Australia give a great show, and you sit down, have a beer and watch a footy game. That's what we're about.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research and website, Anna Whitfeld. The technical operator is Lila Schunner. Our supervising producer this week is Chris Bullock. Executive producer, Kirsten Garrett. I'm Ian Townsend, and this is Background Briefing on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.